Okay, bonds. They seem quiet, stable, maybe even a bit boring.
Yeah, they have that reputation. But think again.
Right. Today, we're sort of peeling back the layers on this financial workhorse. We want to uncover some, well, surprising secrets.
Exactly. Things like unexpected risks, clever strategies companies use. There's more going on than meets the eye.
And we're digging into insights from a bond valuation masterclass and some critical thinking questions that really make you think.
Yep. And our mission really is to give you those key nuggets, help you quickly grasp the mechanics, but also the hidden dynamics so you feel properly clued in.
Okay, so the basics. A bond is basically an interest-only loan, right? You lend money, get these fixed coupon payments,
Periodically.
and then the original amount, the face value,
Yeah.
back when it matures. Simple enough.
On the surface, yeah. But the real question, the deep dive, is how they're valued. What actually drives the price you pay?
That's where it gets interesting.
It's all about something called the yield to maturity, or YTM. You can think of it as the market's current required return for that specific bond.
Okay.
So the bond's value today is just the present value of all those future cash flows, the coupons, that final face value payment discounted back using that YTM.
So the YTM isn't fixed like the coupon, it moves with the market.
Exactly. It reflects current interest rates and the perceived risk of that bond. And it immediately tells you something important.
Like what?
Well, if the YTM happens to be exactly the same as the bond's coupon rate, say 8%, then the bond will sell right at its par value, usually $1,000.
Makes sense.
But if the market demands a higher yield, maybe 9%, so the YTM is higher than the coupon, 9%. So the YTM is higher than the coupon. The price has to drop below $1,000. That's a discount bond.
And if rates fall, YTM is lower than the coupon.
Then it's a premium bond. Sells for more than $1,000. It's an inverse relationship. Price goes up when yield goes down, and vice versa.
Got it. So it's not just the steady coupon, it's really about what the market demands now.
Precisely.
Now, let's dig into some of those features that really change the game. We often think of debt and equity as simple opposites, but debt has a kind of sneaky advantage, doesn't it, tax-wise?
Oh, absolutely. That's a huge one for companies. The interest payments they make on their bonds are tax deductible.
Unlike dividends on stock.
Right. Dividends come out of after-tax profits. So this tax shield makes debt financing significantly cheaper for the company, reducing their overall tax bill. It's a major strategic benefit.
Okay, and beyond tax, what about things like call provisions?
Ah, yes. A call provision basically gives the company the right, but not the obligation, to buy back the bond from investors before it matures.
Why would they want to do that?
Well, think like a homeowner with a mortgage. If interest rates fall significantly after they issued the bond, they can call it back, pay it off, and then issue new debt at the lower current rates. Saves them money.
That's bad for the investor, right?
Yeah.
They lose their high-yielding bond.
Exactly. It's a risk for the investor. So because the company has this option, investors demand a higher coupon rate up front as compensation for that call risk.
Makes sense. And the opposite is a put provision.
Correct. A put provision works the other way around. It benefits the investor. It gives them the right to sell the bond back to the company before maturity, usually if interest rates rise significantly.
So they can get their money back and reinvest at the new higher rates.
Precisely. It protects the investor from rising rates. And because this feature benefits the investor, the company can usually get away with offering a slightly lower coupon rate on a putable bond. It's all about who holds the option.
Fascinating balance. Okay, shifting to risks. We absolutely have to talk interest rate risk. This feels central.
It is. It's simply the risk that changes in market interest rates will cause the price of your bond to fluctuate. Even if the company is perfectly safe, your bond's value can go up or down.
And what makes a bond more sensitive to these rate changes?
Two main things really drive it. First, the longer the bond's time to maturity, the further out that face value repayment is, the more sensitive the price is to discount rate changes.
Okay, longer term, more risk. What's the second?
The lower the bond's coupon rate.
Yeah.
If a bond pays very little interest along the way, more of its total return is tied up in that final face value payment far in the future.
Yeah.
That makes its present value more sensitive to rate swings.
So long maturity, low coupon equals high interest rate risk.
You got it. And this leads to a really interesting point, one that trips people up.
Which is.
U.S. Treasury securities. Everyone thinks they're risk-free. And
Right.
yes, they essentially have no default risk. The U.S. government isn't going bankrupt.
Right.
But they are absolutely subject to interest rate risk, especially long-term treasuries.
So wait, you're saying a 30-year U.S. Treasury bond actually has more interest rate risk than, say, a 30-year corporate bond with a BB rating.
Yeah.
That sounds totally backwards.
It sounds backwards, but it's often true. Think about it. The BB corporate bond's price is influenced by both interest rates and changes in its perceived credit risk, its likelihood of default. That credit risk can sometimes move differently from interest rates.
Where is the treasury?
The 30-year treasury's price moves almost purely based on changes in long-term risk-free interest rates. Over that very long horizon, those rate changes can cause significant price swings. So yeah, the safer treasury can actually be more volatile in price terms due to interest rate changes alone.
Wow. Okay, that really flips the script on risk-free.
It does. It highlights you need to understand what risk you're talking about. Default risk versus interest rate risk.
Right. Let's talk market dynamics. Why do companies bother paying rating agencies like Moody's or S&P to rate their bonds? It's an extra expense.
It's usually money well spent. A good credit rating, say, AAA or AA is like a stamp of approval. Mm. It signals to investors that the company is financially strong and the bond has low default risk.
And lower perceived risk means?
Lower borrowing costs. Investors will accept a lower yield, a lower interest rate from a highly rated company because it's seen as safer. So paying for the rating can save the company a lot more in interest expense over the life of the bond.
So what about junk bonds? Why are they often unrated?
Couple of reasons. Sometimes the issuer knows the rating would be poor, maybe deep into speculative grade, and they figure getting that official junk label isn't helpful. It might just confirm negative perceptions,
right.
Or sometimes it's smaller companies, maybe less frequent issuers, who just don't have the resources or feel the need to go through the formal, expensive rating process. The market might price their debt based on available financials without a formal rating.
Gotcha. And this ties into the bond market itself. It's mostly over-the-counter. Right? Not like stocks on an exchange. What does that mean for, like, transparency?
Yeah, that's a key difference. Most bonds trade OTC, meaning dealers negotiate prices directly with buyers and sellers, often over the phone or electronically, but not on a centralized public exchange like the NYSE.
So it's harder to see the prices.
It can be, especially for individual investors dealing in smaller amounts or less commonly traded bonds. You might not easily see the last traded price or the current best bid and offer like you can with a stock.
And the impact.
It often leads to wider bid-ask spreads. That's the difference between the price a dealer will buy a bond for the bid and the price they'll sell it for, the ask. Less transparency can mean less competitive pricing and slightly higher transaction costs for investors.
Okay, one last really fascinating concept. These ultra-long bonds, like a 100-year bond, sometimes called equity in disguise, what's the play there?
The century bond. It's a pretty clever financial strategy. By issuing debt that matures so far in the future, 50, 100 years out, a company locks in capital for an incredibly long time.
So it feels almost permanent, like equity.
Exactly. The principal repayment is so distant, it's almost irrelevant for current operational planning. But crucially, it's still technically debt.
Which means?
The interest payments are tax deductible. So the company gets the long-term nature of capital, similar to equity, but with the tax advantage of debt. It's a way to leverage the tax code while securing very long-term funding.
Blurring the lines between debt and equity for tax benefits. Very strategic.
Very.
Okay, so wrapping up, we've really dug into the world of bonds today. We went from the basic structure, you know, the loan idea, to how valuation actually works with YTM, and how prices move inversely to yields.
And then uncovered these really interesting features, call and put provisions, the tax shield.
And the crucial difference between default risk and interest rate risk, especially with treasuries. That's a big one.
Definitely. Plus the whole market structure, ratings, transparency issues, and that clever equity in disguise strategy.
Yeah, it shows bonds are way more dynamic than they first appear, right?
Absolutely. Mm. So hopefully the next time you encounter a bond, maybe in your portfolio or just reading the financial news, you can spot these nuances much faster. You'll see that risk-free treasury and think, but what about interest rate risk? Or see a callable bond and understand the trade-off.
Or see a century bond and nod knowingly about the strategy.
Exactly. It adds layers to your understanding.
So here's a final thought to chew on. Considering how deliberately companies use these features called provisions to refinance, ultra-long debt for tax advantages, paying for ratings to lower costs, what does all this detailed maneuvering really tell us about a company's confidence in its own financial health and its long-term strategic vision?
That's a good question. It makes you think about bonds not just as financial instruments, but as signals, doesn't it? Strategic statements.
Definitely something to mull over.